Welcome to Welcome from Woburn Untold Stories. This is a session that will have Ann Anderson and Dan Kennedy. As you all know, Ann Anderson is the lead plaintiff in Anderson et al. Versus W.R. Grace et al. Dan Kennedy was a reporter at the time for the Phoenix.
For the Daily Times Chronicle in Woburn.
And then for?
For the Boston Phoenix,
right.
Yes.
And he has, and actually if you have not checked out his website, he is a storehouse of knowledge, so you might want to check that out. I'm going to turn the program over immediately and ask Ann to tell us how this all began.
It began in January of 1972 when Jimmy was diagnosed with leukemia. And at that time I had only heard of, in my entire life, one child that had suffered that illness. And when he was discharged from the hospital, a neighbor came over and told me of two children that were also in the immediate neighborhood, almost within a stone's throw of us, that also had leukemia. And I think at the time that she was just trying to alleviate my fears and make me more comfortable with the fact that other people were going through with what we were experiencing. But it really did not set well with me at all. Even though I was dealing with him as an ill child, it started to prey on my mind that there was something really unusual if there were so many children, three children at that time, in this real small pocket. And I know a year later when another child was diagnosed, I had already confirmed in my mind that there was a definite problem. But the other problem was that one friend and my mother were the only two people that believed, as I did, that there was something that was some outside influence that was causing this problem. And at that time, there was very little public awareness of environmental issues. There had been no correlation with health effects drawn to environmental issues. And so it was a whole new subject. And it's an uncomfortable subject. People do not want to know that they could possibly be affected, that their health could be affected by something that they can't feel or touch or see many times. And it's difficult to deal with. And often I was being talked to and people were trying to convince me that I was wrong. And there were times that I really wanted to believe that I was wrong because it was more comfortable to feel that. Nobody wants to think that that's happened because of an outside reason. And that's about all I want to say at this point.
As Marilyn said, my name is Dan Kennedy. I'm a reporter for the Boston Phoenix, but during the years in question, I was a reporter for the Daily Times Chronicle and covered the trial and its aftermath. I think we're here at a law school to talk about the legal case, and yet I want to try to steer this in a somewhat different direction because I think that the tendency has become to look at this as primarily a legal case, mainly because of the really magnificent book that Jonathan Haar wrote and now the movie. But in fact, the legal case is really a part of a much larger story that begins with people like Anne, and in fact, primarily Anne and some people who came after that. Let me go back to 1979 when the contamination was discovered. It was actually a colleague of mine at the Daily Times Chronicle, Charlie Ryan, who is not here today, who had a lot to do with the initial part of this story. In May of 1979, it was discovered that some barrels had been dumped in the Abergeona River to the north of Wells GNH, upstream in other words. The state investigated, tested the wells. They found that the contamination that was in the barrels had not made its way into the wells, but they found something else. They found trichloroethylene, tetrachloroethylene, and the other chemicals that were at issue in this case. Now, right from the beginning, federal and state agencies became involved in investigating Woburn, largely because of the activism of the community. In the fall of 1979, Anne and the Reverend Bruce Young, the rector of Trinity Episcopal Church in Woburn, put together a community meeting to ask people whose families had been affected by leukemia and other cancers to come talk about their experience and to see whether there might be any sort of environmental link. Bruce has told me and others that he was not really expecting that much of a response. In fact, the meeting got an overwhelming response, and it was really kind of the beginning of a public consciousness of what had happened in Woburn. At about the same time, the State Department of Public Health was conducting a study as to whether Woburn's rate of childhood leukemia, which they already knew was elevated, was in fact elevated enough to raise the kind of flags that would warrant further investigation. And here's a rather remarkable thing that my colleague Charlie Ryan did. The conclusion was that the elevated leukemia rate was not statistically significant. Charlie looked over the figures with an official from the DPH, and he noticed that they were using a population for Woburn of 40,000, which was what it was in 1970 when the previous census had been taken. Charlie said the population of Woburn today is about 36,000. What would happen if you plugged in 36,000? Well, all of a sudden, the statistical, it became statistically significant. That small change moved it into a new zone, and that really had a lot to do with the subsequent interest by the EPA, the Federal Centers for Disease Control, and other agencies. Now, as time moved on, Woburn and Love Canal probably became the two biggest national symbols of what happens as a result of corporate irresponsibility and what can happen to a community. There were congressional hearings. Anne and Bruce Young testified before a Senate committee, I believe. Senator Ted Kennedy came out. Congressman Ed Markey worked very closely with the community. And then State Representative Nick Paleologos also was heavily involved in drafting state laws that would respond to future Woburns. The State Cancer Registry really came out as a result of this. A state Superfund law to clean up hazardous waste that was modeled after the federal law came out of this. Ironically, Nick Paleologos is now out of politics and is a movie producer and had wanted to make a Woburn movie. It did not work out for various reasons, but that's kind of an interesting sidebar to all this. And another interesting aspect of this is that Jonathan Haar's book is actually the second book that's been written about this case. There was a little-known book written in the early 80s by a woman named Paula DePerna called Cluster Mystery that was really on the whole Woburn case. Now, this was before the trial, so it was not primarily a legal book. It was primarily a science book, and as a result, it was a little bit dry, and certainly it didn't have the success that Jonathan Haar's book had, but I bring it up, it was a good book, I remember interviewing her at the time, and I bring it up again to kind of demonstrate that this is a large overarching story of which the lawsuit was a part. It was an important part, but certainly it wasn't the only part. What I think is interesting about the lawsuit today, which is primarily what I covered. Charlie Ryan covered the early part. I covered the lawsuit and most of the appeals process. you know, this being a law school, I'm sure that you're all very interested in analyzing the ins and outs of what went right and what went wrong and why the outcome for the families was not what we had all hoped. I think what's interesting in looking back is that the lawsuit and the book and the movie have ended up shining a light on this whole issue and on the dangers that probably people face in every community across the country, you know, more effectively than the trial itself really did. And I know that that's not the purpose of bringing expensive, difficult litigation like this, but nevertheless, it's had that effect. And I mean, here we all are today, and I think that, you know, the millions of people who will see the movie, to name the most obvious manifestation of this, even though the movie has been fairly heavily fictionalized in some ways, are going to learn more about this problem and question authority more in their own communities than they ever would have if this had never taken place. I think that's about all I have to say to begin with, but I guess at this point we can open it up to questions.
Can I just emphasize that I have heard Jan relate things that that simply didn't happen the way he says they happened. And one of the things is that, you know, good things happen from this, that the EPA, you know, learned a lot by this. And the fact is that the EPA was on the scene in 79. And Jan was given information by the EPA. And I have a great deal of difficulty with those facts being distorted. He had stated that the parents went to the EPA, and that wasn't as it was either. The EPA came to us, and because they recognized it was a problem, and they were working on the thing. The parents did not go to the CDC. What happened, the way the CDC got involved was after the meeting in October 79, when the parents came. Actually, I had all those names. I had been collecting all those names. And there were no new names that were presented to us, but Bruce Young and I plotted out a map, and it's so clear in my mind, I'm not good with maps, so I read the addresses, and he made the marks on the map. And the next day, he went to Jimmy's doctor and presented that map to him. Everything that I have been trying to get Jimmy's doctor to visualize, he just couldn't. He was treating children, and as I say, there was no real link at that time. People weren't thinking of environmental influences causing health problems, and so it was pretty easy for him to just, you know, well, this mother is really looking for a problem that doesn't exist. But when he saw that map, it was so visual for him that he picked up the phone at that point and called the CDC. The parents did not go to Harvard, and I've heard Jim say this. What happened was, right after Jimmy died, Harvard called Bruce Young and asked us to make a presentation. I didn't think I could do it. And Jean said to me at that time, Bruce said to me at that time, you need to do it. You have to do this for Jimmy. And out of that came the health survey, which was a real asset to our endeavors. And so there were other ways that things happened rather than the way Jan presents it, and I just want to make those things clear.
You know, Ann makes a very good point about the EPA, and I would like to relate that to something that took place during the trial.
The EPA was involved from the beginning and has done a lot of good work in Woburn, but I've always had a real problem with a government policy that I think severely affected the family's chances of winning the trial. The family's case against Beatrice foundered principally because the hydrogeological expert that Jan Schlickman hired, George Pinder, did not present a credible theory as to how groundwater beneath the Beatrice property would get into the wells. Simply put, he blew it. At the same time, there was credible government information at the time that would clearly have shown that water beneath the Beatrice property would flow into the wells. But the EPA, as most government agencies, has an exemption from having to testify in civil suits. Their argument is, well, if we didn't have that exemption, we would be getting called into court all the time and we wouldn't be able to actually do any work. I understand the argument, but it seems to me that when there's credible, neutral, third-party evidence that's being paid for with our tax money, it always struck me as tragic that that information couldn't have been brought into the trial. I think it would have made a great deal of difference.
Who ultimately made that call? Who made that call in the end, I mean, in terms of the final decision that they weren't going to be able to testify?
Well, I remember that Jan brought in an EPA witness to testify, and the witness immediately invoked this exemption, no doubt at the direction of his supervisors. And, you know, Judge Skinner took a look at it, excuse me, and he said, you know, this exemption has been upheld by the appeals courts. There's nothing I can do. He's discharged. Now, one might say, these reports are available. Why can't the reports at least be introduced? The problem you get is, and I mean this is part of the adversarial system of justice, you can't just introduce a report without giving the defense lawyers a chance to put this guy on the witness stand and say, well, how do you know this is true? Did you take this into consideration? So therefore, there was just no way of getting this evidence in. In fact, I have a whole problem with the adversarial system of justice for dealing with a case like this. I don't think it works. I'm hoping I can get to talk about that on the panel later today, but I mean, I just think that you have three competing parties hiring scientific experts, and I mean, my God, it certainly looks to a jury like a lawyer can buy a scientist to say anything he wants, and then the poor jury has to try to figure this all out at the end. It's impossible. It's completely impossible. Yes?
And it's been my experience that too often the truth is withheld for various reasons, and you know, I see it in my work. It's witnesses are frustrated because what they feel, what they would say, would point to the true guilt of a person they're not allowed to say. And I have a great deal of difficulty with motions that are not heard, ballot motions that are not heard because there's some little problem with the way it's presented, or maybe a judge is not prone to hear somebody's motion because he doesn't happen to like that individual. And there are so many problems in the system, I have to get out of it.
It seems to me, to get to the truth, but the way it's worked,
it's not happening.
It's not a problem with the system, it's a problem with the people working with the system.
Well, you know, people are people, and everybody has their own personalities, and if a judge doesn't work well with an attorney, which he didn't work well with Jan, then that presents a problem. He's just not prone to hear what the attorney that he doesn't like is saying. And if he has a relationship with the opposing attorney, then he's more receptive to him.
That I was
looking for the other plaintiffs, Crowley and Howley, and at a certain point in that, were you aware of the judge's adverse reaction to Jan, and if you were, were there any talk about having Ken in the ordeal, or being more of the point person, or were you just not in that loop?
That wouldn't have been my decision, but I did state that to Jan on more than one occasion. I used to say to him, if you make the judge feel like he just had a fight with his wife, then he's not going to be receptive to what you're presenting to him. You know, there's going to be this. And but Jan did what Jan did. But I would rather be on the Jan side and know that he was on the right side than be on the side of the opposing attorneys, which I have no respect for, because I don't understand how they can defend companies that have done what they've done and caused what they've caused. So I do not have any respect for them, and I won't.
You know, not being a lawyer, that makes me naive enough to be able to think about how I would have liked to see a trial like this go. And I mean, I do have a few, if I were designing this type of trial from scratch, I think what I would do, first of all, is I would not have a jury except for the setting of damages. It's too technical. There's just too much that's thrown at them. Second of all, I would have some sort of a court-supervised investigation rather than having each of the parties conduct their own investigation. I mean, obviously, the lawyers for the parties would be able to challenge the court's investigation and perhaps present witnesses of their own to as part of their challenge, but I think that the basic investigation has to be seen as neutral and third party and not connected to any of the parties. And I think as the final thing, I would find some way of bringing in government investigations that have been conducted and that might shed some light on this. I mean, it's my personal belief that if a system like this had been followed in Woburn, Jan would have been much more successful and that the outcome would have been much better for the families. Because, you know, you say this to the W.R. Grace people and they say, we would have loved to have tried it this way because it would have vindicated us. Well, I don't think so, and if it had been done that way, we would have seen what would have happened instead of this ending in this muddle the way it did. Yes?
I asked both of you to reflect a little more and started this about the conduct of Judge Skinner. And also I wanted to ask, Ann, how much of the time were you in court? How much were the families in presence during that stage one of the trial?
Very early in the litigation. I asked Jan if we as plaintiffs would be a part of the court scene because it's my belief that if you have real people present that represent harm, then it's something that speaks to the jury and we're sitting there and these are the people that have been harmed. But his tact was not to have that, and I didn't find out until I read the book that his experience was that if those people that have been harmed are seen later as acting lightheartedly and maybe laughing, which you do, I mean you can't go around crying all the time, and so he saw that as being detrimental because you had these people that were presenting, you know, the people that had been hurt, and then they they're chattering and laughing together, and that doesn't present a, you know, a good portrayal. But I have to differ with them, with jurists. I think jurists do have a place in the system, and I think most people that have served as jurors take it really seriously. My problem with jurors is the way they are chosen. I have a real difficulty in the fact that people actually make a living, it's their profession, to pick and choose jurors. I think it would be a lot fairer if you just threw names up in the air, chose what, you know, what showed up, faced up, and they were your jurors. Because I just, the way it is now, it's so slanted and it's so picked that it's not real, a real representation of your peers.
By the way, before I answer your question, I just want to point out, I don't think many of you know, Anne works in the court system. So, I mean, a lot, it sounds like she's very knowledgeable. She is. She really knows this stuff. I am largely a defender of the way Judge Skinner conducted the trial. I really do disagree with the interpretation that he was out to get Jan in some ways. I think he made one tragic mistake. I think that questionnaire that was submitted to the jury was impossible to answer. And I think that after 78 days of trial with experts talking about travel times and groundwater gradients and all of that, we were all kind of existing in this alternate reality where I can see where the judge would think that those questions made sense. But if you step back for a moment, you say, they don't make sense. There's just no way that that a jury could handle this. In fact, I think that if the jury had been asked a simple question, I think that the verdict they did come back with clearly indicated that they were ready to find that W.R. Grace negligently contaminated the drinking water wells, period. And if they hadn't been asked these impossible questions about travel times and when, and it was just impossible, and that really messed up the whole thing. The reason I defend the judge's conduct for the most part is that Jan was very inexperienced in the courtroom, and it showed, and he really had a very difficult time of conducting his case. And although the judge clearly lost his patience from time to time, I do think he did the best he could to keep the trial on course and moving forward. Just to give one example, when George Pinder, the witness, the hydrogeological witness for the families, stepped down from the witness stand, I think Judge Skinner would have been clearly within his rights to dismiss the case against Beatrice right then and there. He didn't. I assume the reason he didn't would have been that to do that would have really prejudiced the jury against Jan in the remaining case against Grace, and he didn't do that, and he could have. So that's... Yes?
I just wanted to say we were just in Jonathan Barr's discussion, and I'm not a lawyer, I'm a writer, and you know, he talked about how to write the book into a coherent narrative. He finally had to put Jan Schlipman at the Senate. And, you know, obviously it became very much a legal story about the lawyers and all that.
Right.
And I just want to say to you, Jan, that, you know, I think the message that's going to be left for regular people, not lawyers, is that you and the other parents and the priests are the heroes. And that legally you may have lost, but morally you won. So that's my little comment. But I would like to ask you, in looking back over this whole experience, if you yourself could have done anything different, or you know how it's transformed you for good.
You mean how we could have done differently during the trial period?
No, or even before. I mean. Clearly you felt the truth. You have moral courage to act.
my words were not listened to. I was seen as an emotional mom. And I was getting no attention. And it was very frustrating. It really was. It was super frustrating. And it wasn't until Bruce Young got involved in this that the case took credibility. When we had that October meeting, I can remember saying to him, because there was such a sense of paranoia about me at that point, that I said to him, I will go as a parent. Because I thought that if I joined him in this effort, it would be detrimental to the effort. I went solely as a parent. And I sat there like everybody else. And then after that, then I got re-involved again, you know, on the level of getting all the cases pinpointed and sending it off to John Truman. But without his efforts, and these are some of the things that I think I want to emphasize, that before the litigation took place, and it would not have taken place without the efforts of some people that have never got mentioned, that nobody ever remembers or thinks about anymore. But I can remember when we were going to Harvard, when Harvard decided, the Harvard School of Public Health decided to take us on as something that they wanted to do a study on. And they just wanted to help us. And there was just one powerful of people that went to Harvard School of Public Health, and then they came to us. And then we went to them, and then they came to us. And it took a whole year to work out a health study that was palatable to us, that we, on an emotional level, and as we were seeing the community, what we thought we needed, and what they, on a scientific and medical reasoning, thought that would be best to be a part of the study, and working it through together, that was something that we could both feel comfortable with. But I mean, when I'm saying it was just a car full of people that went, that's all, to take this whole endeavor. And it was just, and it was only people that cared. It was just people that thought it was an issue that had credibility and they cared about. And it was before this, and this never would have happened without them. And I just don't want that to be forgotten.
Question. I know I read Dan's article in Phoenix, and I read the report that you found from the late 1950s. The city had commissioned a study to have a water tested, and the testing results came back that the water should never be turned on. And they turned it on, and they pumped it, and as people got sick, they continued pumping it. I am so angry at the city of Warren. Yeah, from my point of view, the worst thing that happened to us was that town betrayed us. And they didn't help through the trial. We were all harassed. We had people screaming at us that, you know, we were devaluing everyone's property. How do you feel about that?
Same as you do, Kathy. I was very frustrated with the city. Not only didn't they open doors for us to be listened, but they slammed doors in our face and they laughed behind those doors. And I know you remember that we wanted to bring the city into this because we were all angry that the city treated us the way they did. They knew that was a problem area. Visually, that was a problem area where they put those wells. We could tell, and we're not engineers and we're not hydrogeologists, and we could tell that they were not good places to put wells because of all the industry and all the dirt and everything that was around there. And our complaints fell on deaf ears. And they were not receptive to anything we said. The Board of Health could have done anything they had the power to do anything, close the wells at any time. It was only after several requests that they actually even agreed to meet with us, and that was under the conditions that we were not allowed to speak. The mayor criticized us constantly because we were not scientific people. We were not medical people. We did not have the knowledge to present anything that had any meaning. And so he thought that questions ought to be directed to Dr. Fitzpatrick that headed up the Woburn Board of Health. But Dr. Fitzpatrick had already stated that he would not answer questions from the media, nor would he attend public meetings. So it was, the whole thing was ludicrous. It was, as Kathy says, it was a very angry town. And we were probably the angriest amongst them, but it was almost hard to hold your head up in town because there was so much criticism against us as plaintiffs.
Can you tell us at all about the role that Al Love played in the litigation? People have said that he was the preppers, and other people said he was the hero.
He was the hero. Strangely enough, I didn't know Al. I knew Al Hadley at all. I kind of knew his wife from going to, you know, PTA at the school. His mother I knew better than anybody because we used to transport her back and forth to church. Very, very nice family. I kind of knew his sister. And suddenly he was at my door. And he just came in and there was an immediate rapport. He just said that he wanted to help. And there were things that he knew that were going on in his company that were bothering him. He knew us and he knew others in the community that had children and adults suffering with cancers and leukemia. And he knew that the company had done wrong and he was there to help us. So at that point I picked up the phone and I called the attorneys. And he is a hero. He put himself on the line. He had to take a lot of grief from those he worked with because they were seeing it as a job. Their jobs being jeopardized because of what he was saying because of his support of us. But he's a dad.
Question about that, because I just always found one of the greatest ironies of this case was Tom Vernon, the city engineer, who was the most difficult piece of this from the local perspective, I think, dying of leukemia. Did he ever turn around in terms of his own view of this once he got ill?
Bruce Young says he did. I had a great deal of trouble relating to him. It was just, we used to say everything was a piece of cake. You know, it was never anything to worry about. We used to call him No Sweat Tom Vernon. And it was, you know, no sweat, no, you don't have to worry, you know, and it was kind of very lighthearted. And I always took it so seriously. I mean, I just, you know, I'd go to these meetings and it was after, you know. And it was just so, just wasn't anything to concern anybody with. And yet on one side of him he had a child that had been diagnosed with leukemia and the other side he had a child that had been diagnosed with Hodgkin's. And I don't know how he couldn't have seen the problem or whether he just didn't want to know about it. And I was the first plaintiff to know that he has been diagnosed, and it was our chief probation officer in work that told me, and I thought, you know, I thought it was a sick joke. I'm like, stop it, you know, and he said, no, it's true. And so I picked up the phone again and told them, but I told the attorneys, but it's my understanding from Bruce Young that he did have a change of heart. I never heard it, but it was kind of ironic. It really was. But when, you know, when we could speak about the Mass Department of Public Health too, because at that time initially they were very difficult to work with. It's not so now, and I give them all kinds of credit now because they have whole departments that are set up to deal with environmental issues. But at that point, when Dan says, you know, we present them with figures, they take what we had in our little neighborhood and they disperse them. And so they wouldn't seem as magnified as they were in our neighborhood. Then they would take mortality rather than incidents, And that's not what we were bringing to them. We were bringing to them incidents, but it was easier to, and Jimmy did not die of leukemia. So even those mortality figures weren't accurate. But, I mean, it just get watered down to, you know, that there wasn't a problem. And you had to keep honing it back and say, no, please, this is what the facts are. But they didn't want to deal with that because they didn't know, we found out later, they didn't know how to deal with it. Yeah.
I'd like to just briefly point out that the government was not united in its opposition to what Ann and Bruce and others were doing. It was divided, and Ann and Bruce and other activists were really brilliant in exploiting these divisions. The city government was against them, but the state representative wasn't, and the congressman wasn't, and ultimately the senator wasn't. And in 1983, 4 years after all this started, the people of Woburn actually elected a reform mayor. And I think that that might have at least had partly to do with public disgust at the way Ann and others were treated. And things did not become, I don't think the relationship between the families and the city government became perfect after that, but they certainly became a lot better.
Well, what we had going for us was we had, at that meeting in May of 79, we had a representative of Senator Kennedy's office. She was his aide, who's still my dear friend. And so ultimately we got Senator Kennedy's support. Congressman Markey, I can remember him going to Bruce Young's office, and it was just the three of us, and he said to me, Ian, what do you want me to do? And it was like, somebody wants to help. We had Nick Palaiologos in our camp. And ultimately, Dick Krause, which was our state senator. So we had important people working on our behalf. And that was really, as much as so many agencies were really not understanding of our issue, they made sure that we got the attention we needed. They made sure that we got funding that we needed, and if it, you know, they were just instrumental in getting so much accomplished.
In back?
One of the difficulties I find in teaching from this book is the fact that the clinic's voices are missing for a large part of it. And I know we don't have nearly enough time for you to try and do all of this, but I wondered what you would say to lawyers in training, based on your experience in dealing with lawyers in real life in this case. What you know, categories of things would you want to talk to law students about in terms of the way that they deal with clients, based on your experience?
Well, it's my understanding that
the profession of law is a service. When I began working at a courthouse, I was told by a clerk magistrate that nobody walks through these doors happy, whether they're plaintiffs or complainants or defendants or witnesses. Nobody is happy. Nobody wants to be here. And when you knock at an attorney's door, there's a problem, and you have a problem. It's an incumbent upon the attorney to listen to you, to treat you with respect, to be open, to have a dialogue, and to make sure that your feelings are known, and to respect those feelings.
I do
personally, in some respect. Yeah.
Yes?
I kept a journal early on of mostly of kids being diagnosed. I wish I had kept the journal that Jonathan Ha had.
I have
notebooks, filled notebooks of various aspects of, you know, what the EPA did and hydro geological testing and families and the trial and Andersons, and it's just, I have so many books, and I have, of course, all the depositions and all those records, too, and I think my attic ceiling or floor is going to fall down into my house with all the records I have up there. But as a daily journal, I have a calendar. But now when I look at the calendars, they don't always make a whole lot of sense because I just have names and places to be and things to do. But there's not enough explanation. Now I do better, but it's kind of after the fact.
Yes.
You said at one point in the Anderson and that Alice had portrayed in the book and the movie that you wanted, all you wanted was an apology. Have you ever gotten one?
No, I have. No. And the reason
behind that is if there's an apology, then there's an admittance of responsibility and our guilt, culpability, whatever you want to call it. Nobody apologizes for something they didn't do. I remember walking through the house one day and Chuck saying he didn't break the lamp. I knew right away there had to be an apology because I was looking for the lamp that he broke. But that's why I think it's important to get an apology, because if there's an apology, then there's an acceptance of guilt on the party's party.
Look, let me add an emphasis to that by reminding all of you that the jury found that W.R. Grace contaminated the wells through its own negligence. That verdict was not thrown out because the judge disagreed with it. It was thrown out because of technical problems to do with the wacky way the questions were worded. I've repeatedly challenged Grace, I mean, in fact, I debated one of their officials on a TV show a few weeks ago, is to you know, honor the jury's verdict and honor what the families went through and apologize. And I asked them again this morning at the first session, and it's just basically the verdict was thrown out, it was too confused to be meaningful, we're not going to take any action on that basis. And I mean, I think that right there says something about what's wrong with the legal system. I have a signal that we're supposed to wrap up. Do we have time for one more question or not?
Can
we do not. Absolutely.
I think there's great merit to this book and in this movie that this whole thing is coming to the forefront again. We're all sitting here. We're discussing it again. This wouldn't have happened. So I'm very grateful for the book and the movie. I'm also very grateful that Beatrice, W.R. Grace have been named again and again and again. And certainly W.R. Grace is very upset, and this is the most satisfaction I've got.
Welcome to the third and final of the morning session. So my name is Henry Wigglesworth, and I'm just going to introduce this session and then sit down and let Harriet Clark talk to you all and then answer your questions. But I'll just say by way of introduction that jury deliberations are always a subject of intense speculation by the parts of attorneys and others as to what goes on in that sort of secret room. And the Woolworth case boiled down to a decision made by six people. And we're very fortunate to have one of them with us today, Harriet Clark. And I think she is going to tell you some about the experience in the jury deliberation room. I think she has even some artifacts to show and discuss a little bit of what happened after the trial. And then we'll answer your questions. So, turn it over to you.
Okay. My name is Harriet Clark, and I'm from Pembroke on the South Shore. I'm originally from Georgetown, South Carolina. I moved here in 1960, married my husband, and moved to Pembroke. I got called to jury duty in February of 1986. I think that's when I got my summons. And I sent it back and said, yes, I would. I was not working full time. I'm a mother of four grown children. I have six grandchildren. Wasn't an imposition to me. I didn't even know where I was going. My husband said, do you know what you could call for? And I said, just jury duty. And he said, yes, you're going to federal court. It entailed me driving to Braintree every day to take the tea. Change somewhere in there, I forget where now, and every morning I get up at 5:30 to drive and get to the T and to drive in to take it into Boston. First day I was there, all these people were milling around and I had no idea, and somebody said, do you know what you're in here for? And I said, just for jury duty. And everybody kept saying, well, you don't want to get on this jury. And I said, oh, why didn't I want to get on this jury? It's going to be too long. Okay. Everybody that I knew was trying to get out of this. And then Mr. Fasher and Judge Skinner decided that they would take each juror individually and ask questions. So they did. They made me, it's not that they made me feel uneasy. In fact, Judge Skinner really knew quite a bit about Pembroke, much more than I did. And he asked me not personal questions, but about the town I lived in. So that put me at ease. Mr. Slickman and Mr. Fasher and everybody. That wasn't a problem. Just make a juror feel at ease, that's all. So he said, okay, you're seated. They didn't object, so I sat. And eventually it was told to me that I may possibly be there for 6 months. 6 months? Didn't anybody have to live? You know, I mean, really. 6 months out of your life, I had a summertime job. I mean, really. In June, I was supposed to be a director of a swimming program. I'd been doing that for 20 years. I wasn't about to give that up. I tried everything I could to think of anything that I could to try to get out of this case. Well, subsequently, I didn't. There were six of us that were chosen. We went on this jury. We came back, I think it was in March, I don't remember the exact date. As somebody just put it in the hallway, we were older jurors. Oh, we were mature. Just remember, we were mature jurors. They somebody has already asked me, how did you choose a foreman? I can remember I was the first juror seated, so Judge Skinner said, so you go and sit in the first seat down there on your right over there. I did, and the next five people went after me, and then there were six alternates. In a civil case, there are only six jurors and six alternates. So Judge Skinner said, is there anybody here who has been on a trial before? And Mr. Vogel had, so he says, you're the foreman. And that's how that was chosen. It was a surprise to me too. Well, I didn't want to be that anyway, so. We get ready to come in, and then we're told about if this trial goes for the 6 months and you find somebody guilty, I can't remember everything that was said, then you'll have to come back again and we'll go from there. Okay? Folks, I did not know where Reuben was. I had heard nothing about this trial. I had heard nothing, I read nothing in the paper. I was a busy housewife being a mother. It was not well publicized in Pembroke about anything about this case. It suited me just fine as I started getting into this. We get into being seated, Mr. Slickman and everybody gets up to make their opening statements, and then they hand me this piece of paper from Grace. There are 139 witnesses. What? Are you kidding? We're going to sit here and listen to 139 witnesses? I counted them. They're all right here. And the Mr. Schlickman, the plaintiff's lawyer, attorney's here, Schlickman, Conway. He's got 33 on the first page. Well, it ended up we had 159 in this one. They hand us 139 for this one, 159 for this one. And then after that, we have a supplemental list of witnesses for Beatrice Foods here. You're to take these, look at them, and see if you know of anybody, know anybody on here. I couldn't even, I mean, really. It was, that was dated February 18th, 86, that they did this to us. And I say they did that to us. List of witnesses here, now this is another one, for Krajovac, 134. Yeah, that's what I said. Are they serious? We'll be here for 2 years. Not knowing who you were going to call. We went through this trial. I did not know what it was about until it was presented to us, the opening statements. I had tried to not to go home and discuss it with anybody. We'd been told not to do that, and I was pretty fair about that. One time during the trial, Judge Kenner says, there's going to be something on a GBHM channel, too. Be sure not to watch it. You know how difficult that is. My husband, really, I left the room. And it's not easy. Everybody wants to discuss it with you. Okay. Then you go and you're hoping when you get on the tee, nobody knows that you were in the courtroom. So you go down like this. Okay. There was a lot of technical stuff in this particular trial. I'm going to go to the end and then please ask me anything you like and I will answer it as truthfully as I can. Some people, even in my own family, have asked me, how in the world could you have not found for those families? I didn't know. I didn't know there were deaths in this family, and any family. I didn't know about the contamination until this trial of any type of water. I come from a background where in the cotton fields, and I worked there in the summertime as a teenager, we used chemicals. In the tobacco fields, we use chemicals. It was not unlike them to throw paint thinner out the door when we finished. I didn't know any better. It's not that I'm saying that it was correct or anything like that. That was the way it was. So when Mr. Schlickman, Mr. Fasher, and all these companies came up and they started bringing up these barrels, yeah? I've seen the barrels. I've walked out in my yard. I have 3 acres of land now. And occasionally, if I find a broken bottle or a rusted piece of metal, I'm always looking now. And this is what you people have done for me. I mean, you have made me aware. You've made us all aware. You've made the country aware. It's not whether I or the other five jurors found for one party or the other party. It is not that, and it's not all monetary here. It's what you've done for all of us. But anyway, well, we get through the trial. And somebody said, didn't you find it boring? There were some parts, please believe me, that I looked up there, even Judge Skinner was snooping. Yes, John was just talking about a display that you folks had made with the water tank. Yes, that was interesting. I could watch water go round and round or whatever it was doing down into the groundwater. Didn't know. They said, well, you're going to have to do these questions, and I said, okay. They handed us these three pages. It was given to the jury on 7/15/86. These are the actual questions that we were handed. These three pages for Grace. Grace and Beatrice Foods. They're basically the same. I won't fool you with reading them all. There are four chemicals here. I can't pronounce them. And this was one of the other problems. We started with chemical, trichloroethylene, yes or no. Tetrachloroethylene, yes or no. 1,2 trans dichloroethylene, yes or no. 1,1,1 trichloroethylene, yes or no. If you've answered no to any of the to all of these chemicals, you do not need to proceed further. Okay, now what they wanted us to do was to take this and have the plaintiffs establish a preponderance by the preponderance of the evidence that any of the following chemicals were disposed of at Beatrice's site after, get this, August 27th, 1968, and subsequently contributed to the contamination of Wells UNH by these chemicals prior to May 22nd. 1979. John just said he thought that we were given the month and the year. No, folks, we were given days. Mm-hmm. We were given a date of the 22nd of May to whether or not it contaminated your Wells G&H. The first thing we did when we got into the jury room is we looked at the questions and I think we laughed. What else could you do? It would be laugh or cry. Mr. Vogel said, we'll take a vote. It was not a split right down the middle right at that time. There were four of us that said not guilty. There was no way that we could decide on this. We had two people, and I firmly believe to this day, that had their minds made up before they went to court, before we went and tried. I'm not going to mention names, there were three of us ladies there, and one of them knew what had been going on. But, fine. Yes, when you get into a jury room, you fight. That is not a joke. You do. You are bitter enemies in there. Okay, I'll take questions. Would anybody like to know? Yes.
The lawyers have talked a lot about this first question. You could have decided either with Beatrice that they didn't dump the chemicals, or that if they dumped the chemicals, they didn't reach the well. Do you have a memory as to kind of what the jury?
We knew that they were dumping. I mean, they had been presented to us, and we had actual people who came and said that these chemicals had been dumped.
With Beatrice on there.
Well, I mean, you know, to the tannery.
Right.
At the tannery. And it wasn't just, and then one of the things, that, and we talked about it in the jury room, how did Mr. Beatrice get involved with the tannery?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and, okay, where was the tannery? Where was it in regards to the wells? So they took us out there. They were not unfair to us. It's just that they gave us so much. You gave us too much technical stuff. We couldn't even absorb day by day of what we had. I don't like the word just housewife, believe me, I'm not. But a working person who comes off the street, we know nothing about your geologies, we know nothing about your lawyers or anything else, and believe me, what really threw a lot of us off, myself really, was this objection. Mr. Fasher played his part well.
Yeah.
He really did. We were Mr. Slickman was going in a mode and a mode, and he kept us going, and all every time that he started something or said something, Mr. Fasher, I object. Oh, a bench conference. Let's have a bench conference. Or the jury take a break, and you go out, and then you come back. Well, this, nothing flowed. There was no way that you could keep everything in your head. Yes.
Okay. Would the adhesive make more sense to you if it had not only the groundwater facts, but also the health facts set out in one proceeding? Would that have made more sense? And the second thing is, to what extent did you distinguish between Grace and the tannery? Because it seems to me the faults or the facts of the contamination were very different in those two cases.
We kept going back to the tannery and then to Beatrice. Well, all of a sudden it dawned on a couple of us. Beatrice was, I mean, that was that one company we were fighting. Mr. Tannery was there. Mr. Riley was there. We weren't fighting just Beatrice Company. We were fighting Mr. Tannery, okay? Now, I hate to do this because now I've seen your movie, I've read part of your book. When I finish this, I'm at 50 minutes from now, I'll relax and start reading the rest of it, you know, to see how much of this book is true. it was very difficult. Say, Grace Company, and I'll tell you how we got to those verdicts in a few minutes, but, you know, this groundwater took this long, and how many inches did it go in this length of time? And if you had bedrock here, did it go over the top of the bedrock? Well, Mr. Dobrinsky, how he ever withstood all of that, you put a lot of time, a lot of work into that. I didn't understand. It just wasn't fair. And I'm not stupid. I just wasn't fair.
Because of the complexity
of the expert witness testimony, did you find that as jurors in the jury room, you were giving greater weight to the layperson testimony than you had heard? Well, we get in there. First, we are not allowed to make notes. Okay, that was one Judge Janus thing. You can't make notes. You'll have to rely on your memory from day one to the day that you went in. Now, you could have anything you wanted. I don't recall. You could have anything you asked for. That's fine. What did we want? When did we think the chemicals, we knew there had been chemicals on that company. What did tanneries use? How did they clean their hides? How did it get from there through the river? Wasn't I taught in my chemistry class in high school that a cleansing goes down, chemicals, water goes down through the your ground through a river, dilutes, okay? Back up to the well and it's contaminated? Does that answer your question? It was just too much. Too much.
As to the tannery, then,
yeah.
The geologists say that the groundwater will go under a river, under a mountain. But that was very hard to come across.
It sure was.
I'm interested also, though, in the first part of the question. The judge cut the trial, depending on how you count it, Jan, not into three parts, but at least four and maybe five, so that you were not going to get to the human beings in the case.
Never.
A future trial.
Never. I think Mr. Slickman at one time said there were deaths involved. Okay. There were deaths involved. There's deaths involved in a lot of things. What caused it? And he says the chemicals caused it. And I've had to really think back on what you opened up with to really make me realize that. Not like I saw in the movie, them on the expressway going to the hospital with a dying child. My sister called me from South Carolina. She said, didn't you know that? I said, no, I didn't. Well, it would have made a lot of difference. But
That's, and as we go along, that's not what the trial was about, was it? It's how that water, I mean, that contaminated, and that's what I think Judge Skinner was trying to do to all of us, to make us understand. And I am so sorry for the families. I really am. And I've often wanted to call them and tell them that, and because I never have spoken to them. But I'm sorry. But you gave me something to do. And one, I was in a focused room. You gave me something to do, and that's what I did. After that was what you people wanted me to decide. And then's when I learned that the families had died, or they had children that died. Why did, and then after all of this, why did you just take two? And then I see in the movie, and my husband says, oh, because they had money. There were other people who contaminated this property, this river.
And,
go ahead, that's okay.
Following up on his question, you said it would have made a difference if
the
families testified to hear their stories. Do you think, can you elaborate a little bit on what kind of difference it would have made?
I think it would have. Let me, just a little anecdote here. I was sitting next to an extremely nice girl, and she says to me, looking at Mr. Schlickman, she says, I don't care what he's for, we're voting for him because good looking. I said, okay. Whatever he wants. And this, well, it was a lighter moment, thank goodness. because I have a heart. I have a heart. I would have felt sorry for those families. And I probably would have if he had told me that the chemicals that came from anywhere had contaminated these families. I think I would have been torn. It's hard for me to say I wouldn't have been with children, with babies.
Do you think it would have been harder to be objective?
Yes. No doubt in my mind. No doubt in my mind, yes.
Mrs. Clark, if you had been asked more simply just yes or no for each of Grace or Beatrice, and to use 51% of the evidence to make that assessment, as opposed to the specific dates, which are really asking you 99.99% of the evidence, do you think it would have been different with a simple yes or no?
With a simple yes or no, did chemicals get there?
From either.
Either or.
Yes.
That, with each of these, I don't know. I was so confused with the names of the chemicals, the amount of the chemicals that supposedly got into there, how many parts per million, per billion. Did I need to know that? Parts per million? Gosh, I'm. Of zeros on there. Yeah. But then, you know, I drink the water every day. I could not imagine that causing death or even causing me to be sick. I still drink it. I buy water now, though. Not always. I like Pembroke water. I bought one today as we were coming up on the train. But I buy water a lot of places. I grew up in a hometown in South Carolina that was sulfur in their water. This was another thing that, I mean, our paper mill sat on that river, on the Wignon River, and they were dumping. They had to be. Smelled. Oh, and I graduated from high school with 98 people. It smelled like sulfur. People used to come from one end of our town to the other. Oh, my goodness, they would hold their nose. And that, and some places they still do today, but because there's still sulfur in there. You tell me the water smells? Yeah? I grew up with smelly water.
How yes? did you ultimately decide to rule in favor of Beatrice and yes? against Grace? So
okay. That's okay. I understand. Yeah. Okay. Did anybody here... Michael Keating this morning. He was right on the nose. Absolutely. Judge Skinner sent us into the jury room. There, we were not split down the middle. I was sitting at one side of the table with four
four people and two more, and two of the others. And we were not guilty for everybody. Nobody. The other two, and it had to be unanimous. And we argued, and we fought. And by the way, I was a smoker. A real good smoker. I mean, we could fill up, this other man and I could fill up that room with smoke that day. Nobody, yeah. And we would come out of there, and I Mr. Schlickman would be standing there, or somebody would be watching us and everything, and we'd put on this nice, clean, lovely face to have lunch. And then we'd go back at it. For 6 days, we did this. One person moved. This other guy said, I don't care which way you go. The majority want to go that way, I'll go with you. I was adamant. I said, I'm not going. Didn't prove to me between these states that water got, that contaminant, these four contaminants got into that water. And I wasn't. I said, there'll be hung jury. And you were right when you said you were worried about me. I was not going to go there. Then it came down to, well, we were split 3-3, 2-4, whatever. Then we sent word to the judge, we're stuck. Go back, try it again. Can't be stuck. And a little while later, Mr. Vogel's heart, he got on heart operation. And he says, you will have to start these deliberations all over again. And I thought, dear Lord, if I have to do this again and fight with somebody else in this room, I'm not going to do it. So we looked at each other, and the ones who wanted everybody to get off scot-free, there were a couple of people besides me, and we decided, well, we'll compromise. He was right this morning. That was what it was. It was compromise. We felt that when they presented evidence to us that the government said no more dumping at Grace, and they ignored that order and continued by their witnesses to pour chemicals onto their property that they were negligent. And that there was a possibility, looking back and thinking back in that jury room, that the water flows downhill. Yes, it does. It didn't have to go through all that rock and all that other place. It could have gotten to the well. Sure. That's the way we split. And that's how we did it. And it's not always what people, whether you're right or wrong when you present your cases. It's, you know, people, we egg on each other and we tug on each other and we fight with each other and we really yell at each other about, did he do this or did he do that? But then you have nothing else to look at. You have no notes to go by. And this is one of the faults that I think that we had there. And it was so much. You just had too much technical stuff for us, for us lay people to comprehend. I'd do it again, yes. Little things. Yeah. Well, we didn't know what the big things were, to be truthful with you.
Yes or no.
Well, yeah, but did you see the question? Here's the stop. Yeah.
So you went through it.
Oh, yeah, we went there through it question by question. Then we were trying to decide, well, which chemical was which. That 1, 2, 3, the bottom A, B, C, or D here, which one was it, the one that caused?
The discussion, were they helpful in that one?
No, absolutely not. Not these questions. Yes.
So about that, can I suggest to take those questions back that none of you could even understand it?
Well, I think it was that it was terrible.
Yeah.
We all agreed with that. It was terrible. We would have never, and I don't think you people as lawyers or anybody else could have understood these questions. I really don't. Yes, sir.
At one point during the jury deliberations, the foreman came up and claimed that one of the jurors was taking stuff out of the jury room and discussing with people outside. Do you remember anything about that happening?
No.
Don't remember?
Uh-uh. They did not ask me to not to take these. The list of witnesses, I took home myself. They said we could. I think they said we could. When I got home the day after the trial. And I put all my stuff in, and I put it in my safe. Do you remember being invited to a party? I have the pictures. I have Mr. Slickman with black hair. No, it was one of those things I put away because I knew something would come of this case. Something had to. We had to clean up this environment. Don't all of you lawyers go out looking for cases to prosecute and everything. You do what you're doing here. Educate the people. That's what you're doing with this book, with this movie, with this forum. Things happen in my day. My sister and I discussed, we sprayed DDT straight onto little flies at my home in South Carolina over food on my table. Yes. Did I know any better? Did my mom know any better? My dad smoked. He had emphysema when he died. Did he know any better? Did we, any of us know any better? We do now. You've made us aware. Continue to do this. Not just sue people for every, yes.
We know what at least one of your colleagues on the jury thought of Mr. Slickman.
Yes.
If you could recall, you know, good
luck. He was tall. Oh, yeah.
If you could comment, even though it was 12 years ago, if you could comment on the recollection of the styles and the impressions you had of the other attorneys, and
okay.
Mr. Slickman, Mr. Thatcher and Mr. Keating, if you recall from their courtroom.
Looking back, Mr. Fasher was the biggest pain in the butt I had. I mean, really, I didn't know this man. He disrupted this trial for us so bad that some days I would go home with a headache, literally.
That's why I came in here.
But as we look back, he did his job. This was what he was supposed to do to all your lawyers. This is what Mr. Slickman did his job. Mr. Dobrinsky, when he was, I never felt more badly for a man. What this man over here did, Mr. Fasher did to that poor man, that his degree, his poor degree, that was, we spent a couple of days on Mr. Dobrinsky's degree. Like, I cared. He was up there giving me some knowledge that I thought I should know. The other, every lawyer in there, if you look, as I can recall now looking back, really did a heck of a job. They kept me interested most of the time. There were times that the technical stuff got boring, but they knew they were. I mean, knew what they were talking about. That was my first trial, by the way. First time I'd been called, and I've been called since then, and I've had two or three summons while I was sitting on that trial. Yeah, they don't give up. But does that answer your question? I thought they were very professional. Of course, not having gone anywhere else, I wouldn't have known any different.
Did you hold against me today?
No, sir. No, sir. We did for a time. You were not,
yeah.
Well, you gave us, I just said to them, you gave us too many. We had too many. Too many facts. Too long. It went way too long. Some days the courtroom was so hot we couldn't breathe.
Mm-hmm. Did you feel that was a strategy of one of the sides to wear you down, or was that
no.
Kind of something that
no, we never sensed that. No, not to wear us down. Uh-uh. They were too busy doing their own thing with their witnesses and so forth, you know. Never to wear the jury down.
You indicated that you were aware of the fact that if you ruled in favor of the plaintiff in this first stage of the trial, that you would have to come back for further stages.
Not at the beginning, we were not aware of that.
At the point you did.
Yes, we became aware of that.
Did that have any kind of a pressure on you, or feeling of pressure on you?
No. No. I would have gone back.
Yeah.
Yeah. But see, I was in a different case. I wasn't full-time. I was full-time mother, but I didn't have a full-time job. That had become my job. That every day I got up and this was my job. And that's the way I particularly felt about it.
Were others expressed the pressure of the length of the trial?
Only one person. Only one person at the time that I can recall felt any pressure. He worked for the post office. So he was a postal worker. And he felt like that he just should get back to his job. Yes.
Can you talk a lot about your experience in your life with various chemicals and how people didn't know when they were using them that they might cause problems later? Did you all talk about that kind of stuff when you were delivering? Did you wonder about whether it was right,
some
of the company liable, it was possible they didn't know at the time.
Yes, we did. Yes, we did. And that was a big factor. And my holdout. Do I know today what we're doing? We have a dump in our hometown. It's just being capped. Solutions. Things coming out underneath. What's going to happen to my grandchildren who have run around the area? And later years, there's still stuff in there, paint thinners, your TCE. Yeah, we did. And it's not that we were that much older than some of you here. We were just mature about it, and we thought about it. And it was brought up. And you brought a doctor in that said, I can't remember who the doctor came in and said that, well, there was no evidence yet that these particular chemicals caused leukemia. Well, that made an impression on a lot of us. Whenever they started, the woman, we all ask in the jury room, why didn't they sue the town of Woburn? Why wasn't they sued? They're the ones that gave you the water in the first place. You had engineers that said there's nothing in this water, nothing to hurt you. And then the guy gets up there and he says, we didn't even have a test. We didn't know what to test for. We didn't have a test for TCE. Why didn't you sue the guy who was just dumping it into the Abernathy River? I don't know.
I don't know. Woburn doesn't have the resources.
I keep remembering. Right.
Which is a legitimate decision when you're bringing a lawsuit.
Well, and it was a decision. I mean, something that we questioned. If you're going to sue one, why don't you sue everybody? But as far as jurors go, just average folks. And that's all you ask us to do a job, and we do the best we can.
So you were trying to pick between the expert witnesses, trying to pick which ones whether you believe Dr. Gubinski or whether you believe the experts on the other side. How did you weigh them?
Well, you mean so that day I liked him. That's it. 6 weeks down the road, I forgot everything he said. Mr. Pender, I felt bad for Mr. Pender. He was not. And then I said, well, I can't judge him. I mean, vote on that way. If I feel bad for somebody, I can't just because I know he's an expert witness in it. But perhaps he gets up on that stage, that stand, and he doesn't remember or he doesn't know how to present himself. But he knew what he was talking about. Mr. Dobrinsky had his stuff under, knew what he was talking about.
Speaking up on Peter's question, you've been able to take notes day by day, putting your recollections down about each expert. Would that have made a difference?
I don't think there were a lot of
statements
in the jury room.
We can't. Take notes. I mean, we couldn't use them. You couldn't take them to the jury room. You might have been able to look at them today. It's just like me reading this book today. Put it away.
Take notes.
No. These are the only things I kept. No, I wish I had on that one. Yes. Yeah. Yep.
What you're describing is a song.
Which one? Oh, which one?
The Martian that you get this very detailed evidence entered into the record for 3 months, 4 months, and it goes on and on, and you take enough, you can't take enough in with you, you can't keep track of the details. And then you get into the jury room, and you're supposed to make decisions about things you maybe didn't fully understand when you heard them the first time, and even if you did, you don't remember them fully right now. Is that a problem?
I think, I would find that a problem because you might remember something that he said, and it may be important to you, but it didn't mean a hill of beans to me. And that way, we're just different, we just see things differently.
Maybe the system's built, so it's only the broad strokes that you remember that make a big difference.
Yes, yes. But can you all understand 6 months is a long time. This is a long time to put, there are people that go home and then have other things to do, other jobs to go to and so forth. That wasn't their main, that was their main focus when we were there. And, but after that, we had other things to think about. Yes.
Mrs. Clark, after 78 days of testimony being in the jury box, the day, the 79th day, when you went to Woburn, how different was it than what you anticipated seeing?
Very. Very. I can remember one of the jurors saying, gee, I didn't know the wells were that close. We went to see the tannery, and that was where he met, the tannery and the wells. Then we went to W.R. Grace, what a nice, clean, spotless looking place. And we saw where the barrels had been buried and so forth, where the work had been dug up. We walked in, slush, mush. It didn't change any. Those that had their minds made up, it didn't change their minds. We just saw a different perspective after we'd seen that. Now, another thing, we might have, had we gone out there a little bit earlier and looked at it, maybe some of that would have made a difference on how we saw that the water ran this way or it had to come through the Rabbitohune River or, you know. But, yes. Okay.
I was wondering if you would be willing to comment on how you saw the judge at the trial. Did you feel that he was balanced and fair? And specifically, were his instructions to you and his charge helpful in guiding the jury and deciding?
Not having been on a trial before, I didn't, he seemed to be fair. I didn't know any difference or, what he should have been like. As far as these instructions, he says, he hands you these papers and the first page you read and it says, don't go any further if you ask. So what's the first thing you do? If it's wet paint and it says, don't touch, what do you do? Touch it. So we go to the next page and we're still reading, and you've got to be kidding. Yeah. Yeah. And I see that, I see right here one of my notes was negligent. This was at Beatrice Food where they make. I see a little word. A little word on it. Negligent. But, yeah. You get three of these pages. There's four chemicals on each page, twice on that one, on page three. And if they caused any contaminants to the well. And he says, do the best you can. Do the best you can. Well, we did. That was, I truly believe that we did the best we could. Either that or you were going to have a real hung jury, you were never going to get anything. Now, I will say this, that after sitting on that jury, going back in, I think it was September, after we'd given our everything that we had and we were coming back, we thought we were going for the second phase because we had found one of these companies guilty. We had discussed it, Mr. Vogel and I, going on the train after all this had happened, and going back home, and we figured, well, here it goes in September, and we wonder how long we're going to be on this trial this time. Judge Skinner sends us to the jury room, and we come back out, and he says, they've settled out of court, you're dismissed. Okay. Oh, well, that's good, we can go home. We go home, and no sooner than we get home, in a couple of days in the paper, we read, thrown out of court. Our decision was gone. What we had spent months, days, fighting, listening, dismissed. Where, all I could think of, and I didn't talk to anybody after that, where is the justice? What was all this about? What was this all about? Today, we had to do it. We wouldn't be here today if we didn't. It had to be done. I listened today to Michael Keating there about this chapter, number 11, whatever it was. Now see, here I go again. That number 11, what is number 11? I mean, that all that did was, right, with a number, it raised something in my head about that. But he evidently knew something else that we didn't. Or he saw the laws differently than we did. And we can look at other cases that have come up recently that have done the same thing. And judges see things differently. We have to have the jury system. We have to have it like it is. You can't, and you have to take the lay people off the street. You have to get them from anywhere you can. And I say it to everybody that I run into lately. I think every person in this country should be made to be sit on the jury at one time in their lifetime to see what this process is about. And that lawyers, too, talk to just lay people. Don't, none of this, you know, high pollutants, I mean, your jargon.
Would be astonished to hear what you just said. Mm-hmm. That, you know, you went through a long thing that took you out of your life.
Mm-hmm.
The end of it was your decision was thrown out.
Mm-hmm.
You left trying to figure out how this could have occurred given the agony that you went through.
Mm-hmm.
And yet you say, you gotta have it this way.
You gotta.
Mm-hmm. I guess I'm confused.
Huh? What else would you do? How else would you do it? You want to present to me, and he wants to tell me something that's gone on. He wants me to make a decision about it. Now we know. Why shouldn't we? Why shouldn't we go through this? I mean, I don't think any of us are, you know, that hold up in our little lives that we couldn't look at somebody else's point of view and be able to make a decision about it. Everybody has an opinion today about everything. I mean, that's, and to put six of us right there and let us fight it out, okay, I'll do it again.
Do you think that, you were 15 to run a jury, and only 60 got to deliberate.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any thoughts about that? Do you think that'll let everybody go, or do you think
I don't think we'd have been out there today if we'd had 15 of us in there. Not with our lives intact, anyway. No, no, no. Been too much. Oh, you would have. Oh. It's still there. Yes. Yeah. No. With six of us, I thought it was bad enough. Yeah. But 15. No. No. And that was another thing. I don't think the whole public is aware of that. On the civil case, there's only six deliberate. You deliberate. The went home, and everybody said, "Oh, well, go." And all 12 of you going in there. And then my sister calls, and she says, "Why do those other guys get to go?" Well, on the civil case, it's only six. In the civil, I mean, a civil case, it's only six. In the criminal, there's only 12. I mean, there's 12. But no.
That's in the federal court. There's still 12 in the state court.
Is that,
the civil case.
Is there? Well, see, I learned. Thank you. But it's a. Any? That one. When somebody says, when you got picked for the federal court, you won the lottery. I said, give me the money first. I'd rather have the money.
Right.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
No, they put them on and then you go to the jury. That was crazy.